Hydraulic fracking. Fracturing. It's a technique that harnesses the natural methane gas that's trapped in shale rock beds thousands of feet below the ground in states like Pennsylvania and Texas. Fracking has helped jumpstart sleepy rural economies, jobs, cheap energy. On a national level, it could catapult the U.S. into global energy leadership, maybe free us from dependence on foreign oil. But it's also controversial. Alex Prudhomme is a journalist, writer of The Ripple Effect, The Fate of Fresh Water in the 21st Century. His new book is Hydrofracking, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's a primer on fracking. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So it's complicated. So give me a 60-second explanation of what fracking is.
Fracking is the injection of a slurry made of water, sand, and a cocktail of chemicals deep underground at high pressure, which then fractures shale rock, very hard rock, which holds little tiny bubbles full of gas or oil. And when the rock is fractured and the chemicals work their magic down there, the gas and oil are sucked up to the surface and captured for our use.
And it is giving the U.S. perhaps production and leadership in natural gas.
Exactly.
Maybe lowering the price of natural gas.
It already has.
Around
no,
the world.
It's been remarkable. The economic impact of this thing is it's really revolutionary in a way. It's a state like Pennsylvania, for example, which has been a gas importer for years, has suddenly got so much gas it's exporting. A state like North Dakota, which was not doing so well, is now a boom state. Texas has always been a big driller's paradise, but they're reopening some of those old wells and fracking them and finding more and more gas and oil. So it's had this rippling impact all across the country to the point now where we're almost a victim of our own success. We've got so much gas now that there's a glut. And at one point, about a year and a half ago, the price of gas dropped 60%. And the impact of that was that, first of all, our gas is cheaper, but it allowed us to stop buying gas and oil on the open market, mostly from the Middle East. That allowed the excess reserves to go to Europe. And it in Europe, it is undermining people like Gazprom, the big Russian gas conglomerate controlled by Putin, essentially. And he has used his gas pipelines as a cudgel to tweak nations like Ukraine when he's displeased with them. And now, just recently, Bulgaria negotiated a 20% reduction in gas prices from Russia because of these excess fuels. So there's these impacts that we're not really aware of in this country that our fracking has caused around the world.
You've also written that because of this abundance of natural gas, it could be seen as a bridge fuel between where we are today and what could be a renewable energy future. How likely is that to be the case?
Well, that's the big question. The bridge fuel is the phrase that people like President Obama or the billionaire T. Boone Pickens in Dallas like to use, because they say, look, natural gas, hydrofract or otherwise, it's all the same stuff, is a fossil fuel, but it burns a lot cleaner than coal. And it burns cleaner than oil. And it is the second best choice, the best choice being renewable fuels like solar, wind, geothermal, hydro, and so on. And we're not quite ready to scale those up to a commercial level yet. But the idea is to use natural gas to do things like not only run truck fleets, but to run your car one day. And it's revitalizing the petrochemical industry, which is important for all sorts of things. And so the notion is that we'll be using this hydrofrack gas to bridge us over to the renewables, which are on the horizon, but are not quite ready yet.
So that's the benefits.
That's the benefits.
But now let's talk about some of the costs. And you wrote about water, which brought you to this whole question of fracking in the first place and how much water is used. Does it threaten water supplies around the world?
I got into this whole subject because I was writing my book, The Ripple Effect, about water. And in November of 2009, I went to the very first and so far the only public hearing in New York City about hydrofracking. New York and the New York watershed upstate happened to be overlying the Marcellus Shale, which is one of the largest energy deposits in the world, the second largest gas deposit in the world, they think. Pennsylvania, our neighbor, is fracking like crazy, but New York has a moratorium on it right now because they're very concerned about the pollution of water. So I came into this as a journalist interested in this question about water and energy because they're very interrelated. But I also came into this with a more personal reason. I'm a citizen of New York City, and my family and I drink the water every day, and I'm very aware of the watershed, which has been protected at great cost over the years. And so my initial feeling about hydrofracking, viewed through the prism of water, is that it's not to be trusted. But that was in 2009. Things have changed quite a bit in the last 4 years. And
in your opinion or in the science?
Both. My opinion has shifted more to the middle. And it's largely because I did this book. I investigated a lot of the positives about it and some of the new technology over the horizon. But the fact is that the industry is maturing, and the little wildcat players who are in there who didn't really know what they were doing and were causing some of the water pollution problems are kind of getting run out of town, and the big boys are taking over. You have giant multinational oil and gas companies in there now. And they play it very safe because they understand the importance of keeping things clean and keeping the public happy and informed. Now, not to say that water pollution is not an issue. It is an issue, but it's not as big of an issue as I feared it might have been. Not only that, it's not just pollution. It's the issue of quantity, how much water they use. You know, each fracked well uses somewhere between 1 and 5 million gallons of water. That's a lot of water. If you're in a place like Texas or Colorado, which is already feeling the effects of climate change, that's a big problem.
But you've written, Alex Prudhomme, that there's new technologies, new substances. Also, some people are thinking, well, we can use wastewater into these injection wells to both contain the water that's used and also to deal with the migration. But do we get migration? And do the chemicals migrate into people's water supply, into aquifers?
It has happened, allegedly. But the EPA has gone back and forth on whether fracking actually caused the water pollution problems that we've seen. They are finally, for the first time, doing a huge nationwide study right now. Preliminary results won't be out till next year, and the final results won't be out until 2016. But it's very important because you can't really build strong regulation without data, and we just don't have data. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that there's been migration. We've all seen the images from Gasland of the guy lighting his faucet on fire. Although in that case, you know, in certain states, the geology is complicated and has been so for a long time, and methane gas, which is natural gas, can migrate naturally, and people have been known to light their tops on fire. But in terms of the general picture, the thing I'm concerned about is the companies don't have to identify what their chemicals are. Some of them are toxic, some are not.
Some are radioactive or could cause radiativity.
No. There are actual naturally occurring radionuclides underground that get stirred up by the powerful pumps. But the chemicals, once you frack the rock, you can't unfrack it. So how do you stop a chemical-laden water from migrating into an underground aquifer where it can go for miles and can be very, very difficult to clean up? So that's one of the issues that they're trying to get to the bottom of.
Well, you've written that some of the critics say the way that this has been looked at is to cut the EPA's budget so that the studies can't really look at these issues. But there are private academic studies being done to try to figure out what is happening with fracking.
That's right, yeah. There's a lot of work being done right now, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see the next couple of years all this research coming to fruition.
When you talk about we don't know what's in there, that's what's in the slurry that's used to
What are the chemicals that they're using?
That's the what's called the Halliburton loophole. How did that come about?
Well, it was the 2005 budget, energy budget, and it was shepherded by Dick Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, and therefore this exception to the Clean Water Act, which allows frackers to not tell the public all of the chemicals that are in their fracking fluids, made its way into a loophole here. And there's been a lot of controversy. Interestingly enough, some of the big frackers, including ex-executives from places like Shell and Chesapeake Energy, have now, in retrospect, said, you know, it doesn't help us to be so secret. We need more transparency. They used to compare their fracking fluids to the secret syrup for Coke, which was guarded as a state secret almost. And, you know, that no longer – I think there's flexibility on both sides now.
Well, there's flexibility, but they still have – even if we know what they are, there's still these chemicals that may cause problems. So you came to it personally.
Yeah.
You want New York City to use hydraulic fracking and get you cheaper natural gas?
Well, that's – you know – the way I see it is it makes no sense to, in the case of New York City, to frack in the watershed. But there are ways of fracking around the watershed, hopefully far, far away, and very carefully with tight oversight. But, you know, I mean, does anybody want a big fracking drill derrick in their backyard? No.
No, but we all want to drive, and
we all want to drive, and we all want to have our modern lifestyle. And so we as a society need to reconcile those two things. You know, we're worried about climate change on the one hand. On the other hand, we want to have we want to keep progressing, and we need energy to live the way we do. And there's a rising energy demand as the population grows. So these are things that we have to, as a society, we have to make a group consensus on and decide. Is that cost something we're willing to pay?
And there's all the question of coal and natural gas and all the other issues as well. All right, you'll take this up tonight at Town Hall at 7:30. Alex Prudhomme talking about fracking in his new book. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks so much.